Hi, folks. Welcome to Podcast Paroxysm. I'm Jordan White, and with me is Jack Winner. Jack, how you doing?
Jordan, I'm doing very well. It's kind of exciting. We're on this podcast together. We've been writing together, known each other for like, how long? 10, 15 years. Now we're on this established podcast. It's good vibes.
It's like we've come full circle.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So let's get down to it. We got two coaching hires we need to talk about. First one, Stan Van Gundy is now the head coach, and I think it was president of the Detroit Pistons. Mm-hmm. Didn't really see that one coming. It's a little weird because we always thought that Van Gundy would go to a contender, a team that was really close to winning the title. But I guess the opportunity to have personnel control and basically to have total team control was too good for him to pass up.
Yeah, I think that's right. He has that total autonomy now that he wouldn't have gotten in New York or Golden State or L.A. And five years, $35 million is it's a hefty price to pay.
Yeah, it is.
But for a basketball mind like Stan Van Gundy's, especially in the position Detroit has been in here really since the Rasheed Wallace, Rip Hamilton teams were broken up here 6 or 7 years ago. It's one worth paying, and I'm really interested to see how it goes. But like you said, I think we were all shocked, and I was certainly surprised that he chose Detroit.
It's funny, we always say that like a coach is, especially a veteran coach like that, is going to wait for the right situation, and I think we always think that to mean a contender. But maybe the right situation for Van Gundy, like to him, was to have a team like this. Like, yeah, he's not going to be a contender right away, but he's going to be able to remake the team in his image, how he wants them to play. It's probably better, honestly, for him than going to Golden State, where they didn't have a lot of flexibility. Not that Detroit has that much, but at least he'll be able to make the moves versus he having to acquiesce to someone else's demands.
Yeah, exactly. And he's one of these guys who's Matt Moore likes to talk about it. He's kind of notoriously hard to get along with, but his demanding style and just kind of grating personality can ultimately wear on teams and wear on players and wear on kind of his peers in the front office. And I think that's what happened in Orlando. And now that, he's in complete control, he can make all these decisions for himself. And I'm actually interested to see who he brings in as general manager as well, just as a second voice and to help him with salary cap negotiations and things like that. The first name, I think, has been Otis Smith, his former GM in Orlando. But like you mentioned, Detroit has more flexibility than people give them credit for. Obviously, Josh Smith's contract is an absolute albatross, and who knows what they're going to do with Greg Monroe. I've always been of the opinion that the Pistons should kind of slow play the Monroe negotiations, and depending what he gets in restricted free agency this summer. But we'll see what happens there. But building around a piece like Andre Drummond is certainly an incredible start and gives him a player to really mold this team around in his vision.
I feel like he's probably going to go insane this first year, though. I mean, he does have to deal with Brandon Jennings. and no coach wants to deal with that.
Well, it's not only Brandon Jennings, obviously, but like I just mentioned, they're not going to be able to move Josh Smith.
No.
Unless I can't even imagine a team like Philly, taking on a contract like that and, bringing kind of Josh Smith's attitude into that locker room. So I'm really interested to see how he deals with Josh and whether he can curb Smith's tendencies, just for the horrible, awful shot selection he's exercised here, really his entire career, and it really reached a nadir last year.
His first year
in Detroit. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure of the stat. There's something.
I think it was sub 30% from three.
Yes, sub 30% from three on a certain number of attempts. He was one of a few guys in league history to do that. He had one of the worst shooting seasons ever last year, and part of that I think is due to the fact that he was irresponsibly asked to play on the perimeter so often. Because Monroe and Drummond were on the inside. So SVG obviously hasn't been afraid to bench players, like put players on the bench in the past who haven't exercised his vision and how he wants to play. So maybe finally he will be the person who does that to Josh and finally gets through to him and really turn him into the player that kind of all around team first, defensive oriented player that he could be.
Hope springs eternal.
That's right.
It's funny, like if we had said this maybe 2, 3 years ago even, you wouldn't have never said that Josh Smith's contract is immovable. But there
Right.
just aren't any that many dumb GMs anymore. Like, most of them are gone. Now all the ones there are either like very cautious of taking on that much money or taking on a player who isn't worth that much money. So I'll be really interested to see if he's even able to move it or if he's going to try and make it work. Because, I mean, no one's been able to get through to Josh Smith.
Right.
It gets to a certain point where you're like, you know what, I'm never going to get through to this guy. He's always going to launch threes. Like, I could show him, I could put the shot chart on like the side of a building and show him where it's good for. And he'd be like, nah, I'm going to keep shooting.
Right, and but I mean, like I said, I think it's important to remember how confident SVG is in his ability to motivate and mold players into the players that he thinks they can become. And like you said, like we've both been saying, I really don't think they'll be able to move Josh. He has 3 years and $40 million left on his contract, and his trade value has never been lower. Not only because of the insane salary numbers, but because of the just putrid season he had this last year for Detroit. But if there's a coach that can get through to Josh, I think it might be Stan Van Gundy. And like I said, especially if he's going to be playing the four and Stan ultimately decides to move on from Greg Monroe.
Do you think that's going to happen? Do you think they move on from Monroe?
At this point, I'm not sure what other option you have. Unless you can move Josh Smith, I don't think you can commit that much salary to just two players who can't play together. And I mean, obviously you'd want Monroe and Drummond on the floor together if they didn't have Josh Smith, but they do, and they're kind of locked into Josh, unless the unthinkable happens and Stan can move them. So at this point, I think the responsible thing to do and the prudent thing to do, not for this coming season necessarily, but for, the coming years, 3, 4 years in the future, is to move on from Greg Monroe, especially because he's probably going to be asking for the max. Whether or not he gets it, who really knows, especially it's kind of watered down, not free agent market, but teams are less willing to offer those ludicrous contracts.
Right.
So yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think even before Stan was hired, I thought they'd move on from Monroe, just based on the construction of this roster. And now that he has been hired, and he has autonomy to make all these decisions, I think Monroe will be playing somewhere else next season.
I have to think that this year is going to be kind of that is the year zero, not even year one of Stan Van Gundy. It's just going to be him maybe laying the groundwork or just kind of playing through what he has, waiting for other stuff to expire, making deals throughout the season. Then the following season is when it's really going to be year one, and we're going to see like what he actually wants to do with hopefully some of the pieces that he wants.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, it's tough to imagine at least the Brandon Jennings we've come to know here over the last several years. It's tough to believe that he's the type of point guard that Stan Van Gundy wants. And his contract actually could be movable depending on how he plays this season. He just has about $16 million left over the next 2 years of his deal. So yeah, that's a movable contract, and I'm interested to see, kind of like what we're talking about with Josh Smith, whether or not Stan can really mold Brandon Jennings into the player that his natural talent kind of suggests that he could become. And if he does, the Pistons certainly have a viable long-term point guard on their hands. But just after what we saw this last season with his almost equally awful shot selection and complete aversion to playing any team or even individual defense whatsoever. It's probably optimistic to think that Jennings is Detroit's point guard of the future.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah.
And then over in your part of town,
Yes.
there's been an equally shocking hire, Steve
Mm-hmm.
Kerr.
Yep.
5 years, 25 million, which is kind of a lot. For a guy who's never been a head coach and hasn't
Yeah.
even been an assistant. But what do you think of it?
When Mark Jackson was fired, I actually said even before Mark Jackson was fired, I said a couple places on actually the Clipper Blog Live pre-playoff podcast, little plug, that I thought Kerr would be a viable option for the Warriors. And that's obviously turned out to be the case. The Warriors hired him to that kind of ridiculously pricey contract. I think it makes him the fourth highest paid coach in the league behind Doc, now Stan,
And
and Greg
Pop.
Popovich. Yeah, wow. But Kerr is a brilliant basketball mind. I think we can all agree on that. It's kind of been a mixed bag as a decision maker in his time in Phoenix. He traded for Shaquille O'Neal. He hired and fired Terry Porter and then hired Alvin Gentry, and the Suns ultimately went on to the 2010 Western Conference Finals as he kind of re what am I trying to say? Re I can't find the word, Jordan. Not I'll just go away from re. He kind of started playing small ball and spacing the floor again with Channing Frye and Amari Stoudemire as opposed to slowing things down and abandoning 7 seconds or less the way he did when he acquired Shaq in Phoenix. So I'm really interested to see how they play in Golden State, especially because whether or not the Warriors are going to go four out and play Bogut or even David Lee in the middle, or play a more traditional lineup with Lee and Bogut or Lee and Festus Ezeli or someone like that at center, will be the way they will be the way they go offensively and defensively going forward. I think that's the biggest question. But like I said, Kerr's a brilliant basketball mind. I think his price was driven a little higher by Phil Jackson's interest in him, but it's certainly a good hire, especially if the Warriors were not going to get Stan Van Gundy, and by all accounts, they were completely unwilling to cede the front office control that Stan wanted. So, in terms of options other than Stan Van Gundy, Kerr was at the top of their list, and they got him.
I mean, I think it's good they got their guy. I just think 5 years is a lot. Now, the likelihood of him running, like if he's bad, of him running through all 5 years, this is the NBA, it's not going to happen. But the thing I'm most interested in is just like, what the heck is he going to run? When he was being courted by New York, it was thought that he was going to run the triangle there because that Phil wanted someone who would run the triangle. Was he going to completely abandon that? Then even like that tendency in Golden State, like obviously we haven't even heard what he thinks, what kind of system he'd want to run. And if I feel like he's going to be a guy who's going to tailor it to his personnel, but Mark Jackson, for all of his faults, did craft a pretty good defense. And so I just have to wonder if which is going to take a step back and which is going to take a step forward.
Defensively, I said right as Jackson was fired that I can't imagine the Warriors taking a huge step back on that end just due to the talented personnel they have on this roster. Andre Iguodala, Andrew Bogut, Draymond Green, and even Klay Thompson are really, if not, I'd say Iguodala and Bogut are kind of universally known as elite defenders. Draymond Green is one of the most versatile defenders in the NBA. He can guard one through four, and he did a in the Clippers series, he was equally adept checking Blake Griffin and Chris Paul. How many players in the league are capable of doing that so well? And then when Draymond wasn't guarding Chris Paul, Klay Thompson did an absolutely fantastic job on him. He's really quickly developed into one of the best young two-way wings in basketball. So just with that wealth of talent on hand defensively, it's hard to see the Warriors taking such a big step back on that end. Especially with the way Mark Jackson kind of instilled these defensive principles into this group. Offensively, Kerr actually told Tim Kawakami of the San Jose Mercury News that there would be some elements of the triangle offense in what he'll run in Golden State, but that he'll also be influenced by his past influence, like Greg Popovich and Lenny Wilkins. Obviously, that's all coach speak at this point, and we have no idea what he'll be running. But just as a guy that probably sees more Warriors games than any other team in the NBA, I'm relieved to know that he won't strictly be sticking to the triangle because the Warriors don't have the personnel on hand for that kind of offense.
No, and I really like to see that in a coach, a guy who's not going to just be stringent and strict to one principle. I mean, you can't be in the NBA anymore. So it's good that he says like he's going to take all elements, and like you said, it's all coach speak. But if it works out, and if really does keep to what he said, instilling those different principles, I think it's a good hire. I like him, and it's not like they were going to get anybody that much better for what they needed. Like there was talk of Lionel Hollins, which that would have been a disaster.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I was telling some friends the other day Actually, it was just yesterday when Kerr was hired. I said, I'm happy about the Kerr hire, but I'm just more relieved by the fact that it wasn't Lionel Hollins, because
Right.
I wouldn't have been able to take a couple of years of following a team like that after his last couple of years in Memphis. That's not to say Hollins isn't a good coach, but just his reluctance to analytics and his kind of relationship with the media got a bit grating after a while. So Kerr is
Right.
certainly a very good option for the Warriors. There's so much unknown here, as we were just discussing, on both ends of the floor, but he's a great basketball mind. He's friends with Joe Lacob and Bob Myers. I think that's really important to the Warriors, that he'll be the organizational fit that Mark Jackson never was. And that kind
Right.
of top to bottom synergy is something the best organizations in the league, you think of San Antonio, Miami, that's something they have, in addition to incredible talent, of course. But the Warriors will finally be on the same page, from top to bottom. And I think that almost matters as much as anything else here.
Now, given the vagaries that we just discussed, who do you think is going to benefit most from Kerr's presence?
I think Steph Curry is as strange as that is. I think he really can take another step. Kerr also mentioned in the interview with Tim Kawakami that he'd be foolish to abandon pick and roll with Steph. So I imagine we'll see even more just high pick and roll with Steph, and maybe some weak side options on the other side, getting Klay open and things of that nature. And Kerr also tried to trade when he was GM's general manager of the Phoenix Suns in 2009. On draft day, he tried to orchestrate a trade to acquire Steph. His fondness for Steph as a
Right.
player are well known. So I really think he'll give Curry even more latitude than he already had, more latitude, more freedom, and more responsibility even than Mark Jackson did, and kind of put the ball in his hands, almost in the way that Kerr, as general manager, he wasn't coach, obviously, almost in the way that he did with Steve Nash when he was in Phoenix. I think there's another step for Steph to take, and I think Kerr is the kind of the right guy to coax that step out of
I think Curry almost had too much freedom,
him.
and I think giving him the sort of structure in a weird way is going to free him more as an offensive player. He's not going
Yes.
to, maybe he still has the ultimate green light, maybe he won't, but giving him a structure, giving him an offense, and like to work within the confines of that offense, but then also, because it's going to get you open more. You're not always going to have the ball
Yeah.
in your hands, but like you're going to have more openings. You're just going to be a better player for it, and I think that's going to help him immensely.
Yeah. You actually said it. You articulated that better than I did. Curry had ultimate freedom under Jackson, and I think he'll have probably just as much under Steve Kerr. But the Warriors' offense will just be so much more continuity based, and that will really help in kind of freeing Steph, not only for tries beyond the arc and pull-up jumpers, but driving lanes and giving him the ability to show off his kind of drive and kick nature that really has kind of been overlooked because he's such an incredible shooter, arguably the best shooter in league history. He's almost an equally creative and skilled passer.
Right,
So
yeah.
yeah,
I'm excited
I
to
think
see more of that come out this year.
absolutely. And I mean, it's actually a good point to bring up the talents of other players on the Warriors roster. This is a very, very talented passing team. David Lee is a great passer. Andrew Bogut is one of the few centers in the league who could actually kind of run offense through at the elbow or at the nail, kind of in that Joakim Noah mold. He's not the kind of driver or penetrator or finisher that Joe is, but he's a fantastic passer, and he can put the ball on the floor once or twice and draw defenders and things like that. And then Andre Iguodala, obviously, kind of in that point forward role we saw from him at points this season. I think kind of more motion-based continuity offense will really benefit the Warriors. They were, I think, just middle of the pack. I don't have the stats right in front of me. I think 13th in offensive efficiency this year. What was it? 12th. Dang. One off. They're 12th in offensive efficiency this year. And this is a very talented roster. They have one extremely gifted individual scorer in Steph. David Lee is a very good scorer, of course, in the post. And Klay Thompson is a dead-eye shooter. But Iguodala and Bogut are awesome playmakers. Draymond Green is emerging. Hopefully Harrison Barnes can kind of emerge from the abyss that he was in this entire season.
What the heck
There's
happened?
talent here. The thing with Barnes is that people got far too excited in the playoffs last season when the Warriors
When he was
were
the
forced
definition
to.
of an outlier?
Yes, exactly. The Warriors were forced to go small after David Lee's injury, and from there, the Mark Jackson just exploited. He loves exploiting the mismatch, obviously, and I just hate even bringing that up because it was just so frustrating watching the Warriors constantly go to Klay Thompson and Harrison Barnes and Andre Iguodala in the post on supposed mismatches on smaller guards. But Barnes kind of exploited Tony Parker and Ty Lawson in the playoffs last year on, and he scored, I think, 16 or 17 points a game, but he did it on 15 or 16 shots. He wasn't that efficient kind of breakout scorer that everyone thought he was. We just looked at the raw per game numbers. But yeah, I mean, even so, even having said that, I didn't expect him to regress the way he did this year. And certainly if Kerr kind of takes the approach of playing more small ball and playing Barnes and Draymond at the 3-4, I think that'll benefit Harrison. So we'll see. Barnes certainly has potential, but at this point, Draymond Green has kind of usurped him in the Golden State pecking order.
Right, and it's just weird to see that because I mean he, there's talent there. There's obvious talent. It's just it doesn't come out when it comes time to actually play.
You know, we talk about the talent with Barnes, and he certainly has some. Obviously, he's great size for a small forward, about 6'8", kind of sturdily built, and he's a great leaper. He can really run. He slides his feet well on defense. But when he has the ball in his
He's not very
hand,
fluid, though.
exactly. That's what I was getting at. After two or three dribbles, when he has the ball in his hands, he just has no idea what to do. And that's an innate thing, I think. And it's something that can be developed a bit, but you either have that or you don't. And Barnes isn't one of those scorers, that really has the knack to get by a defender or create space for open shots. And he's not fluid from side to side with the ball either. So that's something kind of overlooked with Barnes because people see him and think he's this amazing fluid athlete because he's such an explosive leaper off 2 feet and can really slide his feet on the other end. But he's much better without the ball in his hands than he is with it.
And I so that I have to wonder, if Kerr's gonna go away from what he doesn't, from what Barnes doesn't do well, and just use him like, look, we're gonna take the ball out of your hands even more, and just use you as a cutter, as a guy who's gonna move off screens and whatnot, and just kind of go ahead and forsake the stuff he's not good at, rather than try and develop that to the point where he can maybe use it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's absolutely the approach. Barnes actually shot well from 3-point range this season. What was it? Just pulled it up here. At least I thought I did. He's a good shooter. He's a good open 3-point shooter. Oh, yikes. It wasn't nearly as good as I thought. He slumped towards the end of the season. He only shot 35% from three this year. So that's not encouraging at all. I expected it to be 37, 38. But I think he could turn into a dependable 3-point shooter in time. And like you said, he could be a very effective cutter off the ball. And the Warriors have enough ball handlers with Steph and Iguodala, and like I said, even David Lee and Andrew Bogut, where he could kind of take advantage of all the attention they draw off the dribble. So he, for the Warriors to take the next step, Harrison Barnes needs to take a step himself, and he didn't this year. And that was really one of the reasons why they kind of underachieved relative to the sky-high expectations this season.
Well, moving on, let's get to, actual basketball things that are happening tonight.
They sure are.
We got two potentially series deciding games. We have Hawks Pacers game six and Clippers Thunder game six. Let's start with the Hawks and or sorry, I got that wrong. Wizards Pacers. So what do you think's happening in Indiana? Are they back? Are they just inconsistent? Is what's going on? Tell me.
I wrote about this for HP the other day, as I said earlier, and the Pacers aren't as good as they seemed when they were 16-1 to open the season, and they aren't as bad as they seemed in March, where they were really a below-average NBA team. They're kind of what they are. They're kind of the team we've seen thus far in the playoffs. Kind of an up-and-down team that just has inconsistent offense because of the talent on hand. Roy Hibbert's not an efficient post-up option. David West is a good mid-range shooter, but those aren't the shots that are efficient. And when Paul George isn't going the way he has been for the majority of this postseason, And he didn't for the majority of the season as well after such a hot start. Where do the Pacers go offensively?
Evan Turner, clearly.
clearly, Evan Turner. Bring in Evan Turner and Luis Scola and see how that works out on the other end of the floor.
Oh my God, it's been horrible.
Exactly. And that's kind of what Frank Vogel has to go to sometimes when the Pacers get so stagnant offensively. But then they experience such a big drop off on the other end. They need to win with defense. And once they get past kind of their starting five, and especially if that starting five doesn't have it going on offense, they take a big dip on the other end. I expect the Pacers to advance, but to advance to face Miami. But I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure. I know they're not the juggernaut that we all thought they were.
That's why it was so baffling to me the last round when people were saying Vogel's coaching for his job. A lot of this has to be put on him. It's like, well, hold on a second, because Larry Bird was also the guy who gave him these pieces. He was the one who gave him Scola and Turner, and so like he has to work with the hand he's dealt. Now that doesn't mean he has to play Turner, but I mean Turner, for all his faults, is still an able body, and he's probably better than Donald Sloan.
I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, and so I mean, yeah. Well, Vogel could play Copeland more. It'd probably give you a lot more offense. He's gonna hurt you on defense too,
Right,
but
and just real quick, the thing about Copeland is they have to play him at the four, and then that goes against the identity they've been building for the past 3 or 4 years. That just completely changes the way they play on both ends. And that's a lot to ask to just kind of go away from everything you've been built around,
Don't
by
you think
playing.
they almost need to at some point? If they're, I mean, right now they're not staring
Right.
down elimination, they're still up. But if it's something that's proven to give you a boost, even if it's in limited minutes, isn't it something you should look at a little bit more?
Absolutely, if their backs are against the wall, but right now their backs aren't against the wall. No matter how poorly they played in game five, and no matter how poorly they played in game one before that, or how kind of discombobulated at times they looked against Atlanta, they're really right on track, to get to the Eastern Conference Finals. And that's where we thought they'd be. And despite the kind of tumultuous regular season, they're going to end up right where they want to be against Miami. And they're uniquely situated to match up against Miami. Miami struggles with size. We all know this. Jared Dubin and I have actually talked about it in the HP threads. I don't think Roy Hibbert is going to be the dominant offensive force against Miami this time around that he was in the last year's playoffs. And I think that will ultimately be the difference. But Indiana has a chance, obviously, against Miami. They match up really well in the wings with LeBron and Dwayne Wade, and then they can kind of pound them with size and on the glass. So the Pacers are right where they need to be. Even if they don't win game six tonight, they'll have a game seven at home. And that's really all that matters at this point, right?
Yeah, I just, someone was saying in the thread as well, I think it might have been Steve, where if they do advance to the conference finals, which it looks like they're going to, even if they advance past Miami, this thing is still broken, isn't it?
I think it's broken, but I also think you can expect more progression from Paul George and Lance Stephenson.
If they
And
keep Lance, which I don't know that
I
they're
need
going
right
to.
exactly if they keep Lance. I didn't think they'd be able to. And when they acquired Evan Turner, there was a sizable portion of people were saying he was Lance insurance if Lance gets a crazy offer in the summer.
That is
But
ter
Lance,
that's a terrible insurance plan.
I know I never thought that was the justification behind the Evan Turner trade, but yeah, if they keep Lance at this point, who really knows? He hasn't been playing nearly as well as he did recently, as in the first few months of the season. So who knows what kind of offer he gets? But should they keep him, I think it's logical to expect more progression from he and Paul George, because at this point, you can still see how green both of them are.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, their blueprint is an interesting one because it's just so different than the direction the league is trending, in terms of small ball and spacing the floor. The Pacers don't do that, and some teams need to go another direction, and that's how they'll take advantage of market inefficiency, right?
Right.
And the Pacers, kind of because of the personnel they have on hand, because they've committed so much time and resources to Roy Hibbert, are going that way. And I don't think it's a bad strategy. And just because they're unlikely to advance to the finals this year doesn't mean they're broken forever. I think it means they perhaps should alter things a little bit and kind of have an ace in the hole of a Chris Copeland type, where they can actually play small on occasion when they need to kind of get things going offensively. But I really don't think this thing is broken or needs to be broken up, and that's why all the Vogel talk of him being fired a couple weeks ago, those reports, whatever they were, I thought were ludicrous.
Yeah, they were idiotic. I didn't get that at all.
I'm a huge Frank Vogel fan. I have been for really since he took the job. I think he's one of the brightest young minds in the game. I think he's certainly the guy to lead this team going forward, and I really think the future is still bright in Indiana.
Oh, there's no question about that. I just think broken is always in degrees.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's an easy fix, sometimes it's not an easy fix, but I do think what's ailing the Pacers right now, I think it's an easy fix. Whether that means, whether that's a chemistry thing, and that's a bit harder to fix than just a straight X's and O's thing, or exactly, if it's a strategy thing. And like, but both of those things, like, they'll have an entire summer to address it. Whereas now they don't have time to really address and like do quick fixes, because that won't work right now. Right. They just got to soldier on through, and then, come next year, I expect to see more wrinkles, more progression, like you said.
Mm-hmm. And I think the locker room stuff is almost as concerning as the on-court stuff.
I think that's more concerning, to be honest.
Right, yeah. One directly leads to the other.
Yeah, exactly.
More than anyone likes to believe. And maybe the Pacers have, Paul George and Roy Hibbert and a couple of others took that fishing trip last week, and that supposedly made the difference in Roy Hibbert's play. And they got rid of Andrew Bynum, and look at the stats when, Roy Hibbert's stats with Bynum and without. Wow. maybe those things are real. I'm trivializing them now with that, with my typical brand of sarcasm. But, those things matter in basketball. Like I said, more than anyone likes to admit. So if the Pacers can kind of develop the unique locker room cohesion that we all thought they had, if they can redevelop it this summer, kind of recommit to themselves and recommit to team first basketball, who knows, maybe next season they win 60 games and are the favorites in the Eastern Conference.
Right. I obviously chemistry is huge. I do think that getting a guy like Bynum out of there was big. Like, he was, mm-hmm. I don't know. The chemistry thing is just, like you said, it's huge, but it's not like a quick fix. It's not like, okay, how it would be, or I want to put this guy in a wing pick and roll versus put him in a pick and roll at the top. Like, you can't do that with chemistry. You can remove guys or you cannot remove guys. But anyways, let's talk a little bit about the Wizards, because they've done a really good job despite having Randy Whitman as a coach.
Yeah.
he actually has done a very good job this series, and against Chicago. He's obviously not the coach for them going forward, or he shouldn't be. but it seems like Washington's benefited from having these amazing outlier performances.
Yeah.
Martin Gortat last game was unstoppable. Which Martin's a good player.
Right.
But he's not game five good.
No. I mean, no center in the league is as game five good as Martin Gortat was. And that's actually really interesting. He's a free agent this summer, and the Wizards will have ample cap space. Trevor Ariza is also a free agent. So they have some really, really important decisions to make. Gortat and Ariza are kind of really important to the fabric of this team. They play two bigs. They space the floor with Ariza and Brad Beal around John Wall's penetration, and kind of rely on the three. And Ariza's had a better season than I think anyone anticipated. Really on both ends. He's developed into the three-point shooter that we kind of thought he would be when he was younger with the Lakers. And defensively, he's no stopper, obviously, but he's lengthy and quick and committed. So the Wizards have some really big decisions to make this summer. Brad Beal and John Wall, obviously a fantastic foundation. Nene, when healthy, as we've seen, still one of the most effective two-way bigs in the league. But those ancillary pieces really, really matter. It starts with Ariza and Gortat for the Wizards.
Do you keep them around then if you're the Wizards after this summer, or do you let them go and start trying to look for other, like,
That's a fascinating question, and one that I think my answer and kind of the perception would be different of if the Wizards hadn't beaten Chicago in round one. Because then kind of the Wizards have just looked at, oh, as a mediocre 44-win team in a dreadful conference, as opposed to, they nearly made the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, maybe you have to bring this band back together for another 2 years, for another 2 or 3 years, with the success they've had here in the postseason. It's a really difficult question, and one I'm glad I don't have to make, and one I don't think the Wizards are the Wizards front office brass is really, frankly, equipped to make.
Right. Now I'm with you there. It's weird. It's a team that's succeeded, like I said, in spite of having Whitman, in spite of having, their GM. It almost makes you sad because you wonder how good they could be with proper management, top and coaching, top to bottom.
You wonder about that with so many teams, and with people like Sam Hinkie and Rob Hennigan getting jobs in kind of this is going to make me sound ageist, I guess, this younger generation
You
kind of
just had to
taking
go to
over.
my two favorites, didn't you?
I did. I said it for you. I'm playing to the host's interests here. You wonder what kind of organization the Wizards would be if they had, better leadership from the top. Ted Leonsis, I think, is a good young owner. He's been willing to spend. But Ernie Grunfeld, I think his time has passed. I'm really trying not to come off as, the typical young person here. But I think his time's passed, and the Wizards would be in a better position if they went a different direction, which makes their recent success kind of puts them in such an interesting position. Because, like I said, do you bring this band back together? And are you content with the way things have been going? Because really, the past, how long? Decade almost? Nearly decade has, the Wizards have been a laughing stock. And they weren't this season, and they certainly haven't been the last month. And the question is, how much credence do you put in this recent success? I'm a process over results guy, as I think most people are now. The process for the Wizards still isn't as good as the results have shown it to be, if that makes sense.
No, it
Which I
does.
think.
It's like what Amin said yesterday with his terrific West Wing quote, the post hoc ergo hoc propter hoc, which is like, so the Wizards made the playoffs, therefore their rebuild or whatever process was successful, wherein like that's not the reality at all.
Right, exactly. You guys, by the way, you guys always mention all these West Wing quotes in the daily thread and on Twitter, and I
Oh
just feel
no,
so.
don't tell me.
I no, no, I'm not a West Wing guy. Absolutely not. I tried watch. I don't like Aaron Sorkin. Can't do it.
Oh no.
No one actually talks that way. No one. I like to believe that quick, witty dialogue exists in every human being in America, or not just America, Earth. Untrue. And it's one of the reasons why I didn't like The Social Network very much, for instance. It just all comes off very smarmy to me. But this is a different this is another discussion, and one I've
Oh
been
no,
meaning to have with all of you.
I really hope Matt doesn't listen to this.
I know, now I'm realizing I really shouldn't have brought this up at all. I'll be fired here soon enough. So
Well, we better move on before we get any deeper into that.
that's right.
So we got Clippers Thunder tonight as well. Coming off that just absolutely insane and bizarre finish from Game 5, which made no sense. Like it's, I wrote about this. The refs didn't lose the game for the Clippers. The Clippers lost the game. Chris Paul, I don't know what the hell he was thinking, trying to take that half court three while hoping to be fouled by Russell Westbrook. It's like, just hold the
You
ball.
just
You've won the
you just
game.
ha You just have to believe that he almost forgot how much, the unique situation and how much time was on the clock. Chris routinely, whether a team's going hack a DeAndre or they're using their foul to give in the last seconds of a quarter, he routinely tries to get those free three, I'm sorry, free free throws, if that makes sense, in that situation. And he did it that time, and that was just vexing. But like I said, he just must have forgotten the situation. Or maybe he just has utmost confidence in himself that, you know, that's that was going to work out for him. But obviously it didn't. And, you know, it wasn't just that. It was, you know, he had a couple turnovers there in the half court, too, towards the end of the game. Notably, on the game's final possession, when he was fouled by Reggie Jackson.
That, and he had the shot, too.
He had the shot, and I actually think he was – are you saying he was trying to dump it off to Blake?
I don't think he was. Someone was saying that he was trying to dump it off. To me, it just looks like it was poked out, and he either lost the handle or it was poked, and that was game. But he had the shot twice.
He had the shot twice, and like, he beat Serge Ibaka with like, another fantastic hesitation dribble.
Yeah.
And he created that space, and he took one more dribble than he needed to, and I think as he was pulling up to shoot, Reggie Jackson just clearly got him right on the forearm. And obviously stuff like that is missed on a possession-by-possession basis.
Sure, and also the last play of the game. As much as I hate to say it, that those things like aren't going to get called as much.
Yeah.
Like, which is stupid, because it should be. But, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was just – it was a bad closing 47 seconds for Chris Paul.
Right.
I mean, for the entire Clippers team, but still was – it was just bizarre. And the explanation that the officials gave, where they said they didn't have a clear view, and then the release that the league said sent out, where that also didn't explain everything, especially because then you could see there were people did screenshots of like the monitors the refs were looking at, and there were clear views.
That was the especially frustrating part for Doc Rivers and the Clippers, I assume, even as a as an analyst and fan. What the officials supposedly told Doc in the statement the league released were completely contradictory. Though I do think it's worth mentioning the rule book, actually, and this is in reference to the Jackson Matt Barnes out of bounds call. Zach Harper of CBSSports.com did a fantastic quick post on this. That the rule book says in that situation, the hand is basically part of the ball in that situation. So Matt Barnes hits Reggie Jackson's hand, and the ball clearly goes off Reggie Jackson, but because Barnes hit Jackson's hand, which hand is the ball rule, that basically means he hit the ball out of bounds. Does that make sense? What I just said?
Yes.
Didn't really sound like it.
No. Well, but then, which is funny because that's exactly like how the rule comes off. Where you read it, you're like, what?
Right. Exactly. And then there's the question of whether or not that means is it only off Jackson's one hand? Because what happened was the ball was in Jackson's left hand. Barnes hits Jackson's left hand as Jackson is trying to switch the ball to his right. The ball goes off Jackson's right hand. So then it becomes a question of the rule doesn't specify whether it's one hand or two hands in regards to the offensive player. Bizarre call, obviously, and one, no matter what side of the fence you're on, I think you're not totally confident in. But like you said, it took a unique set of circumstances for the extremely questionable officiating down the stretch to really matter. And that unique set of circumstances was the Clippers playing really incomprehensible basketball, really for the last 3 minutes of the game. They got so bogged down offensively. Jamal Crawford had two or three just late pull-up threes in the shot clock, and I think Doc even said it after the game, because they were playing not to lose as opposed to win, as teams tend to do when they have big leads late in the fourth quarter. So yeah, tonight should be another fantastic game, as every game in this series has been, and I'm just praying for a game 7 because I want to see more.
Oh, I do too. I want to see game 7, especially just to kind of wash the taste out of game 5.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll see one though, or do you think that was kind of like the Tim Duncan 3-pointer?
Nice. Yeah. I picked the Clippers in 7 before the series. And to be honest with you, I'm not even really sure why. I could talk about it a little bit, but it's really just splitting hairs with two teams this talented. And so I'm going to stick with the Clippers in 7. And I know the stats. I think the home team in game 7 wins, 79-80% of the time. Something but the Clippers like have won this iteration of the Clippers. Well, not this iteration. The Chris Paul, Blake Griffin Clippers have won a game 7 on the road in the past. And I think they're uniquely situated to do it. I think they're obviously better coached than the Thunder. And I think despite what we saw in game 5, they're better in late game situations than the Thunder.
Well, and here's what gives me, I don't know about confidence in the Clippers, but kind of makes me want to choose the Clippers at least tonight. I don't know about if I want to take them in 7.
Mm-hmm.
Everything had to go wrong for them to lose that game. both them playing wrong and them and the refs, and everything had to go right for Oklahoma City to win that. If it is just a game where it's like normal and not Murphy's Law strikes both teams, benefiting one and hurting the other, then the Clippers win that.
Right.
So that's what kind of gives me just a bit more confidence in them. And I don't, you know, I think Doc is so good at instilling confidence in these guys and calming them down that I don't think they're going to be that rattled or have that game five hangover. You might see it a little bit, but I think he's going to get them ready to play. And I think Chris Paul's going to go off tonight. I think he's going to be pissed about how he played. And I think you're just going to see just that like lethal surgery that he just operates with.
I like that lethal surgery. As if when you go under the knife, you want it to be lethal is a good thing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think Chris Paul sees blood tonight. If we're sticking with the, you know, with the surgical talk, I think he sees blood tonight. And I think he comes out really aggressive, and that doesn't necessarily mean shooting the ball. I think he gets into the teeth of the defense and creates for himself and others, really from the game's outset. It should be another great one. Just real quick, I just want to mention, because this series has been so well played and competitive, it's been easy to not miss, but just to discuss other aspects of it than Russell Westbrook's insanely awesome play. I said this on Twitter, and I was talking to some of my buddies about it the other day. If Russell Westbrook really is the clear-cut third best player in the world, how can you choose against the Thunder to win the title if he's going to continue playing this way? It's absolutely unbelievable. And he's been fantastic since he came back from injury the second time this season. I don't have the stat in front of me, but I think he was top five in the league in PER after that. I think it was around 28. And in against the Clippers in this series, he's averaging 37 and 8.
Those are good.
A little right. Okay, is 53% from the field and 41% from three good?
I mean,
because it sounds good. I'm no basketball expert, Jordan. I'm not, obviously, neither are you.
Neither are you.
But those numbers sound good to me.
I like those. Those are good.
He's been absolutely incredible, and those statistics really just mention the offensive side of the ball. He's been an absolute hound. Really since I guess game two on Chris Paul. When we talk about Russ, you know, in addition to the kind of questionable decision making and pounding the ball into the ground, the other big deficiency is that he hasn't developed into the lockdown defender his physical traits suggest he could be. Mm-hmm. But just his commitment and intensity on that end of the series has really been at an all-time high. And maybe this is, you know, maybe this is him turning the corner from kind of a wildly talented, frustrating player, just a top 10 guy, to a surefire top 4 or 5 guy in the league. And if that's really the case, the Thunder are better situated than, you know, even we all thought they were. And obviously, we've kind of thought they'd be a dynasty here since probably 2010, 2011. But if Russ is this guy consistently from this point forward, the rest of the league should run and hide.
Oh yeah. I've been writing about this, and it may or may not appear somewhere, that it's still to be decided, but just the point guard battle between Chris Paul and Russell Westbrook has been terrific, not just because they both played well, but they both played to the absolute epitome of their specific styles.
Yeah. Which are so different, obviously.
They're so different, and that's why it's great. And like you see him, because Chris Paul is just—he's methodical. He doesn't have that burst that Westbrook does. It's like impulse versus intelligence. Not to say that Westbrook isn't an intelligent player.
Yeah.
But for him, it's go go go. It's I'm gonna use this pick, and I'm not gonna plan what I'm gonna do before I use it. You know, once I see what's happening, then I don't know. We'll see what happens. But it's just been absolutely incredible to see him play this way, because, you know, you see him play through, like, you know, the first two games, you're like, okay, like, you know, that was good. But, you know, we've had these flashes from Westbrook before where he plays with that sort of focus. And you're like, is this going to maintain? And then three games later, yeah, it has maintained.
Yeah.
He's been absolutely incredible. And it's weird that he's still not talked about. Like,
just that drastic improvement is still pretty underreported.
Well, it's just so easy to talk about the controversy in Game 5, whether or not Chris Paul can kind of regain the form that he showed during the regular season after this lingering hamstring injury. And then Kevin Durant struggles, relative struggles, we should say. He obviously really, really, really struggled in game 5 and
right.
kind of came on late. But yeah, Russ is easy to overlook, which is amazing considering his kind of how loud his play can be, good or bad. But it's the bad things that tend to stick out to people. When you see him pounding the ball at the top of the key, pulling up for 18 footers in transition, that stuff tends to stick out more than the rest because we expect him to be great. And we keep hoping that this kind of questionable decision-making won't be there anymore, but it kind of persists, but it's that relentless attitude and kind of style and personality. He just keeps coming and coming and coming, that makes him really the dominant force he's been in this series. But yeah, hopefully as this series goes on and should the Thunder advance, Russ starts to get his due because he's really, other than LeBron James, I think you can make an argument he's been the best player in the playoffs thus far.
I agree. I mean, at least the second round. He did struggle against the Grizzlies a little bit. But,
yeah.
I definitely agree with that. You got anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so. I think we pretty much covered all the bases.
This was fun.
I thought it was fun, Jordan. You made me feel so comfortable on my first Hardwood Paroxysm podcast. I was nervous talking to a big shot like you. You have like 1,000 more Twitter followers than I do.
Yes. Okay. Please, people, if you're listening to this, go follow Jack. He's at Armstrong Winner.
Nice.
He has the best middle name.
Thank you.
Of anybody, really.
I can't speak for the quality of my tweets, or even the quality of my content, or the quality of this podcast. What I can speak to is the quality of my middle name.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So if for nothing else, just follow me at Armstrong Winter, and you'll just remember that. Oh, there's some guy who comes off as intelligent in basketball Twitter just because of his name. Yeah. So just do that, and that'd be good for me.
All right. Well, Jack, thanks for coming on. We'll do this again soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Jordan.